You are listening to No More Normal. I'm Khalil Ekolona. 12 months ago, executive producer Marisa DeMarco and I were busy having conversations about how we were going to make a show that covered the response to a global pandemic. What did we want to talk about? What was not being talked about? Where were the nuanced highlights that offer vital information? What type of life and death decisions are being made by public officials? Who needs the help and where is the help? We've worked hard over the last year to provide those answers. The thing about the pandemic is that we're all going through it, every single one of us. As we thought about looking back on a year, we threw around a lot of ideas for guests, politicians, leaders, organizers, and we arrived at how about just people? People who lived through it, day to day.
I had all these ideas about who I thought I should be or what I had to be. And when I let go of those things, that's when I can really encounter some peace in my life.
That's Rolando Watts, who spent the whole pandemic sober and in recovery. Hang tight. There's more from him later on in the show. It's No More Normal, a year into the pandemic.
Hey, I'm executive producer Marisa DeMarco. The stay-at-home order forced some people to do something that they may have never done, talk to their neighbors. That is not a problem for our host, Khalil Ekolona, and I can vouch on this. Spend any hour on Khalil's porch, and you'll see quick that he knows everybody on the block. Today, he brings us a piece on how the past year has been in his neck of the woods.
Oh, who are the people in your neighborhood? In your neighborhood, in your neighborhood. Say, who are the people in your neighborhood? The people that you meet each day.
Edo, or east of downtown, which is my neighborhood, an uncannily quiet part of Albuquerque. Here you can hop on I-25 lickety-split, take a walk to the park, or enjoy a cocktail on the rooftop of one of the more swanky hotels in town, back when the rooftop was open, or sometimes open. Through all the changes we experienced with the shutdowns, reopenings, color-coded COVID conditions, one thing remained consistent. My neighbors. Alicia Webb has been my next door neighbor for a decade. Standing in our respective yards, we often talk about the world and how Generation X has to fix it. She's a single mom, so I asked her about what her thoughts were a year ago as the shutdown was beginning to take shape.
I was trying to figure out what the hell I was going to do with a kid at home for the next 2 weeks or 3 weeks, because it was just go home for 2 or 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. Little did we know that it just kept going and going and going. It was terrifying. I had no idea how to do it. My kid's in first grade. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I don't think it was easier for any kid, but it was really, really hard. I'm really happy because I reached out for help and got parenting help and was able to sort of really focus without a lot of distractions on my life here at home. And my parenting, and that's been really great. But at the beginning, I was terrified. I didn't know what I was going to do for who knows how long, just me and my kid at home.
Alicia and her daughter Calliope, you'll meet her later, have an apartment on the back of their house. In it lives Catherine Hudson and sometimes her boyfriend Sean Gay, both under 35, both in the service industry. We sat in my living room and they told me what they were doing as news of the shutdown broke.
I was managing the press club, bartending over there at night and working during the day and organizing events. And basically my entire life was working and I was just a workhorse driving.
Yeah, like 80, 90 hour weeks. I had just started working at Uptown Funk in Revel. We had our soft opening, our grand opening, and I worked one weekend and everything got shut down.
I don't think any of us really knew how to process it. It was by no means did I expect for it to last this long.
Across the street lives another couple, David Hayden and Lynn Embick. Lynn, who works as a STEM instructor for the Department of Defense Starbase Youth Program, explains what life was like for them in 2019.
We had a pretty active lifestyles. We went out frequently. We were going out for drinks, not nightly, but very often. Pretty active in the local art scene and getting out and seeing new exhibits every week and work, a lot of work. And we had just gotten a new puppy.
Yeah. Yeah. Just had a new puppy. I was working as a project manager for a small construction company here in town. Yeah. And then
boom.
And then boom, everything shut down.
Almost everything shut down. I live with two of my longtime friends. Our friendship is nearing 30 years of existence, hence, we really understand each other. Actor and educator Benjamin Eaglin reminisces on his plans last March.
I was preparing for my twin sister to come for our birthday, her and a couple of her friends. I'd gotten them an Airbnb, and we were going to go to Taos, and we were going to go soak at Ojo Caliente, and we were going to do it up. And then on the 19th, they were like, this is going to be the last day of work. Then my sister called and she's like, yeah, getting on an airplane is not going to happen. So it just all got canceled. And on the day of the birthday, it like really hit me like that something was happening that we had never experienced before. And it was heavy. What I was thinking was one thing, how I felt was something completely different. I was thinking, okay, yeah, when things go down, you know, you get into mode, you get into action, born for this, built for this. That's what the Eaglins are. That's who we be. But the feeling was more sinking and bigger than I could intellectually comprehend. So it was, yeah, it was heavy.
While the gravity of the situation was busy setting our backsides firmly on the bench of sit and see what happens, I had two neighbors who weren't even living in New Mexico this time last year. On a fall Sunday, I saw my neighbor taking his usual morning walk. Wearing his winter coat and Green Bay Packers hat, he glanced over and waved. We made some football banter and I asked him his name.
Glenn Lopnow. So 1 year ago, I was in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, and I was a professor of chemistry at the University of Alberta. Grew up in the South Valley, went to Rio Grande High School. I got divorced about 4 years ago, and then I started dating in Edmonton online, which was a new experience for somebody who's in their late 50s. Mm-hmm. I was not having much luck, and so I was down here on a sabbatical for a few months and thought I would try online dating in New Mexico.
Okay.
And really found somebody who's turned out to be my soulmate, somebody who I feel like I've known all my life. We did long distance relationship for 2.5 years, actually. Mm. One of those years during the pandemic, having to be separated for 8 months. And finally, I retired and moved down here. And Now we're living together. And it's just been an amazing experience.
Glenn was not my only neighbor to rediscover New Mexico last year. Artist and creative Eva Avenue moved into the neighborhood sometime in the summer. We hung out on my front porch as she told me where she was when COVID struck.
I was working at the New York Times Editing Center. At the time, I was getting these stories that I had to read a lot.
Okay.
It was freaking me out, and I was a nervous wreck. I was in Florida. That was scary, too. So because it was COVID, my jobs went remote. So I've been hiding out in New Mexico since June.
Why do you call it hiding?
I'm hiding from large crowds of people who don't think COVID matters.
Okay. But there's pockets of people here in New Mexico who don't think COVID matters.
Still less people.
Okay.
Still less people than the East Coast.
Okay.
It's fine. They can. They're still over there.
All right.
Yeah.
You can't always escape from your housemates. When sharing a living space, you're bound to run into each other. There are moments like, you know, you're eating your lunch and your housemate is working out in the home gym. That's where I caught my other housemate, Stuart Doris, a restaurateur while he was pumping iron. We spoke about where he was exactly a year ago.
I was thinking about here comes spring, here comes summer. It's time to get in golf shape. But yeah, that all changed pretty quick on, I think it was March 20th, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. Safety first was what came to mind. How horrible is this thing? You know, is it going to be like Ebola? Thank the universe that it wasn't. My first quick reaction without thinking about much was like, everybody just get on unemployment. It was brought to my attention very quick by some of my employees that, hey, yeah, that makes sense, but we need more leadership in figuring out how to go about these processes. Mm-hmm. The other thing we did to keep our employees from becoming drastically worried was we raised their pay immediately. We didn't want them having to fall into mental despair because they wouldn't be working.
Mm-hmm.
We really came together as a team and a family and have gone way out of our way to support each other in times where somebody's stressing out. Depression's a big thing, and
yeah,
everybody's got to help each other.
So these are some of the people in my neighborhood. In part two, we're going to reflect about the experience of the last year and how it's really affected their lives.
They're the people that you meet
when you're walking down the street.
They're the people that you meet each day.
In the fall, reporter Nash Jones spoke with a public school teacher and parent about the tough choices she faced in the pandemic.
My name is Claire Porter. I teach U.S. history to eighth graders with Albuquerque Public Schools. I am married to a teacher as well. We have two small children. My husband and I, shortly into the pandemic, realized that our son was high risk for serious complications with the coronavirus, and we were encouraged by our pediatrician to not have any sort of child care for him. So we realized that one of us would need to stay home. So I took family medical leave, unpaid, for the whole year. If I had applied for ADA accommodations or taken a remote learning opportunity, I would have to reapply for my same position the next year. We're now a single teacher family income, so we've been kind of trying to tighten things up at home.
Nash followed up with Claire last week for No More Normal. They talked about what a year of medical leave has been like, what she's thinking as the state announced schools have to reopen, which means her husband will have to return. And they spoke about the lessons she'll take from these experiences into the future, both in and beyond the classroom.
We've been incredibly lucky over this year. Lucky that we can afford to take this time off. We've been lucky, too, that we have a small bubble that's kind of served as a support network. My parents live in town and have helped out a little bit with the kids. And we have a family friend, and they have kids that are the same age as our kids. And I've been babysitting them a couple days a week to give some semblance of normalcy to our children.
Of course. I'm so glad you've been able to do that. So do you remain on medical leave through APS, or what is your status with your position currently?
I can keep my eighth grade U.S. history teaching position as long as I return next school year. So my return to work date is set for August, the beginning of the year. So I'm on leave for the remainder of this school year. I was paid for the first 2 weeks, and I used my sick leave at the beginning, but we've been unpaid since September.
And is your ability to take this leave and still have a position waiting for you in August, is that related to COVID protocols that APS has set up, or was that through a medical leave opportunity that APS already offered you? What did it look like to get approval for that?
Yeah, it was already offered. The FMLA leave, Family Medical Leave Act, has been in place for a while, and you can take it for yourself or for another person in your immediate family if you have to care for, I think, an aging parent or a sick child. And so because our son qualified with the doctor's note at the beginning of the pandemic, I was able to take off to care for him.
So the state announced this week that all schools must fully reopen by April 5th. Meanwhile, the state health department has made educators eligible for the vaccine and is prioritizing them over the next couple weeks. What are your thoughts on that decision?
Oh, man, I think I'm not excited about it. It seems so incredibly rash, especially it felt kind of like emotional whiplash this spring with all the board decisions. But this seemed so sudden because the conversation up until this point has been about returning to school safely, about keeping students separated and how to maintain social distancing in school to keep things very safe. And then this week, the difference, I think, is that they're saying, well, and starting on April 5th, any and all students can return, and please try to do social distancing when and if possible. Mm-hmm. For me, it just feels a little scary that we're this close to having nationwide virus control, statewide virus control, and we're ready to just throw it all out the window at the last minute.
Under the state's new directive, teachers that are at high risk for a severe COVID infection can remain exempt from in-person work until they're fully vaccinated. You're going back in August because of your medical leave. If you were to go back this semester, would you be able to qualify for that exemption?
I would not, because it would be my son and not me. So that would be a risk that we would be concerned about bringing into our home.
If you were in that situation, how would you feel about returning to your classroom?
I would feel terrified. I think I would actually consider taking a leave of absence or finding a way to resign temporarily and hope they have positions later. You know, I think that's a conversation that a lot of teachers are having right now, you know, because even though all teachers are eligible now for vaccine, they don't all have them yet. You know, by the time school starts, they won't be fully immunized. They will have had the first shot, but not enough to really feel safe.
Do you plan to get vaccinated?
Oh, definitely. I can't wait.
You talked a little bit about how this leave has illuminated how much you love your job. I imagine missing it as much as you have been. Do you feel like there are lessons that you've learned this year during COVID and during your medical leave that you think will inform your teaching into the future?
I think that this year has kind of opened my eyes to how much students are dealing with at home normally, and even more so this year. And so I think I can imagine going back and feeling quite a bit more patience than normal. I feel like we've had an easy time with COVID overall, and it has still been difficult emotionally, and it's been challenging and frustrating. So I can only imagine how difficult it has been for many more of my students.
What about more broadly? How do you see your pandemic experience impacting your outlook on life beyond the classroom?
I think it's been, as a parent, I've been thinking about it a lot, and this extra gift of time that I've had to spend with my children and kind of preserve their innocence a little bit longer before they start off for school. I'm homeschooling my daughter for kindergarten this year, and it's been really fun to do all sorts of hands-on type projects. Mm. And I think the chance to kind of slow down, even though it was definitely forced and wasn't,
yeah,
wasn't my choice, has been kind of beneficial, I think, to have some opportunities for boredom. It has been good for our kids and for us as well. And I'm trying to think how I can not just fall back into the rat race.
Right.
And enjoy little things more and appreciate small moments more, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a nice silver lining to some of what we've been through. Thinking about, okay, you know, when our safety and health isn't at risk, when we're not losing our community members every day, what does it look like to preserve some of what was maybe helpful or healthy about that?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's some greater lessons too in this pandemic, certainly. Definitely shone the light on racial inequality in our country and how we need to move forward with that, with anti-racist policy work. And it's also kind of, I think, really brought to the forefront just how severely we're damaging the environment as a human population, and how that's, we're seeing those effects, you know, with all the hurricanes and the fire season this year. And then the virus itself, I see that this is not a one-time thing that we survived. I fear it's going to be more reoccurring unless we really get our act together.
Claire Porter, U.S. history teacher with Albuquerque Public Schools. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
That was reporter Nash Jones speaking with 8th grade history teacher Claire Porter. Thanks, Nash. Late last spring, executive producer Marisa DeMarco interviewed her cousin, Orlando Watts, for the show. He had gone into an inpatient recovery program for substance abuse before the lockdown, and when he emerged, the world was in full pandemic mode. As she contemplated what to contribute to this episode looking back, Orlando sent her a text with a photo of his one-year sobriety chip. She caught up with him last week to talk about his journey and process.
Super intense experience. You went away to rehab. You come back, it's full pandemic. Let's start there. What was it like to get your one-year chip for you?
It's super emotional to think about because, you know, the days leading up to it, even now I'm getting emotional just thinking about it. But the days leading up to it, I remember I kept getting hit with all of these memories about, like, what I put people through. Right? So, like, my wife wondering if I'm gonna make it home, and you know, my mom, you, my family, just, I know, like, all of the heartache and anxiety that I caused to have an entire year of continuous sobriety for me, when I know all of the things that I had to struggle through to get to that point, right? There was a lot of attempts
to get sober before this last stint in rehab that didn't really pan out. I would start to think that I'm normal again. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I'm hit with this overconfidence thing where I start to think about like, oh, maybe I can handle substances again like a normal person.
Right.
And so it led to a bunch of stumbles through this journey. And, you know, sometimes they were longer than others. And yeah, all of those things kind of come into your mind, right? Like, because you know what you've been through to achieve that.
Yeah.
And like, if I wasn't so plugged in, it would have never happened, right? Which is so important, right? Like, I'm plugged in spiritually, mentally, physically, emotionally to my community. You know, my relationship with my wife, my relationship with my family, other people that are struggling with addiction. Those are the community that I choose to surround myself with. And it's like all of that comes like flooding back. And it's overwhelming. And I'm eternally grateful, first of all. Like, I spent some time with my wife and my mom on that day. It was super cool because I also get to hear, you know, what they have to say. But also, like, Paige, my wife, brought out this picture of this little boy. And it was me. She was like, I knew this little boy was in there.
Yeah.
That was important for me because I feel like there is, you know, some part of this. We all have this like inner child that was put through a bunch of stuff, right? Like, we had trauma. You know, we go through things in life and all of a sudden we're adults and all of that has played a role. We don't really take the time to look at that, right? Like, where that child who's just a child who's beautiful, innocent, all those things, right? And how it grows, you grow to be this adult. And what I took away from that was, you know, I definitely got to this place where I wasn't the best version of me. Now it's like I get to work towards the person I want to be and away from the person that I was.
Yeah, and I can attest that you're a really beautiful child. I was there, and we were best friends.
Yeah, yeah.
I wonder why the hardships that you feel you've caused for other people are the thing that came back on the 1 year. You know, I get that you're like examining your whole journey, but I wonder why that was feeling especially sharp, because we've talked about those things before. I know they're always part of your process.
Well, you know, it's not so much that other people made me feel that way. It's that it's more that like addiction is wrapped up in a lot of shame and guilt, right? And trauma and things that are exposed, right? And it manifests itself in the form of addiction, right? So drugs and alcohol are just a symptom of those things, right?
Right.
But because I felt so ashamed of the way that I behaved or the things that I put people through, it ended up in this cycle where I would make myself feel bad and I would beat myself up, and then I would continue that process over and over. And the only escape I could get from it was drugs and alcohol, right? Which led to more hurt feelings and more bad behavior and so on and so forth. So when you have this like milestone, it's just an opportunity for me, because a lot of what I'm doing is self-reflection, because I feel like that's the best path towards growth for me, right? And recovery. One of the things that we learn is like, you know, we don't regret the past, yet we also refuse to shut the door on it. It's important for me to remember where I've come from and also where I want to go.
Can you then hold those feelings, right? The like acknowledgement or recognition feelings, and then move through the guilt and shame? Like,
absolutely.
Are you able to like, I don't know if like letting it go is the right way, but have it not turn into the negative cycle?
Absolutely. Right? And so the only way I've found is to talk about those things, right? Like, if I let those things live inside of me, right, then they're going to grow. Now, if I shine light on them, if I expose them, I don't have to live in that shame.
Yeah.
I don't have to feel that guilt. But it's only through this process of, I do work with a therapist. I
go to group recovery meetings, yeah. you know, I do all of these things and I talk about the pain, right? And I talk about it in front of people that I don't necessarily know.
Yeah.
Right? And that takes courage, right? It's healing. There's healing through those things by communicating. I don't let them hold power over me like I used to.
Mm-hmm. And I think we, I don't know if this is exactly right or if it's too general, but I kind of feel like we as a culture pre-pandemic were pretty averse to acknowledging pain people were in and grief and endings. And it always just kind of, even now, you know, it feels like I'm going through a grief process and it always just feels like the expectation is you should just get back to work. Just go.
Right.
You know, return to the office right. and be okay and show everybody a brave face. And
right.
there's not space in our world for managing guilt, grief, shame, hardship. No. Like, we're talking about it and just having it be received in a way that isn't like, oh, you're bad for still being hurt, or oh, you're weak, or oh, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I feel like there's this whole, I don't know if it's the culture or what, but there's like this mentality of suck it up.
Yeah.
Yeah, everybody's life is tough, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Why do you need to talk about it, mm-hmm. right? But I think that's changing because of the way that people's mental health has declined. I think when you're affected by it personally, or you know somebody that you really love and care about and they're going through it, you see the toll it takes on them. That's when we can show like compassion and empathy for those people and be like, okay, what is it that we can do to help them? And sometimes like that's the toughest thing is you don't know what you need. Like you're right, like, right. I don't even know what I need. I just know I'm broken.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's partly what happened to me. Like I just kept going.
Right.
I experienced super big losses in my life. Our grandfather dying, you know, all these things. We were young when that happened, right? Mm-hmm. But it was super impactful for us, right? But nobody ever really teaches us those things when we're growing up. Like, hey, this is what grieving is. This is what it means, like, what it means to deal with stress on a healthy level. Mm-hmm. I think we're so caught up with chasing money and success and what that means that we forget that there's your happiness can't be bought. Right?
Yeah.
We get focused on those things and then we're so fixated on achieving them that we sacrifice. We just suck it up and we keep moving forward and we take it on until we get to this breaking point. Mm-hmm. And you've seen me at multiple breaking points,
yeah.
right? I mean, it was so amazing to have family like you, like my mom, like all of my family that was so understanding. My wife, who risked a lot for me, to have people step up and say, like, we're not going to take this anymore. You're in a bad way and it's not okay anymore. We're not going to pretend like you're okay.
Yeah, I guess I'll share with you that while I'll never forget those times that were hard, they're now also mixed with, well, they were always mixed with beautiful memories. Like, I see you fully. I see you from when you're born, you know? So it's not only like, there's been hard times. For sure. And I accept that they were brutal on you and on all of us. And
yeah.
But they're not the only things that I think about you. Like, yeah. I think about you from when we were tiny kids. Those memories are vivid. Racing bikes with you or playing roller skates or climbing trees or doing whatever, laying around and making up songs or singing songs.
Yeah.
Being in the back of my dad's station wagon.
Camping.
Camping. And, you know, just all that. Yeah. All that is part of my memory of you. And then now, like through the pandemic over the last year, I also have a lot of nice memories of you showing up for me, you bringing me food when you were worried, you sharing your milestones with me, all of your sobriety milestones. And me, like every single time you tell me a thing like that, it just like makes my whole day. Like, because when we had this conversation a year ago, you were saying that in some ways you feel like this is the chance, right?
Yeah,
and if you hadn't gone into recovery a year ago, that you don't know if you'd still be here, right?
It's so true. Like, I know how isolation and when it's encouraged, how it can really play a factor for me. Going back to what you said, it was like, there is so much more to people than just their drug abuse or their substance abuse, you know.
Or that hard day that you had or whatever.
Yeah. Or if they're, you know, experiencing loss or whatever, or their depression, right? There's so much more to them than that. But sometimes that's all we can do is like show what's right in front of us. And that's like all we show people, right? It's like when we stop and we have to deal with our emotions and navigate these new experiences, like the change that we've all experienced over the past year, it's our opportunity for growth. But I found that like exercise has been the best thing for my life. I went through some very hard seasonal depression through this last year of sobriety. I've never been sober when the seasons changed before. Right.
Yeah.
And so the days are getting shorter and it's getting cold and it's hard to go outside. And so it was like, all right, well, again, what am I going to do? How am I going to change this? You know, and it was hard. It's hard for me. I don't like running. I'm a little bit overweight and, you know, it's hard on my body. So what did I do? I just walked for 15 minutes a day and started there. Just start where you are. It doesn't matter. It can be so, so impactful. Having a good routine has been really, really helpful to combating that depression for me.
I'll add to that, that something that's useful for me is like, yeah, I know the things I'm supposed to do to feel better. I know that I need enough sleep. I know I need to get on a walk. I know I need to not eat cookies all day. Like, I know that.
Yeah.
Sometimes you're so sad. You're so sad. And people are like, well, did you go on a walk? And you're just like, no,
right.
Like whatever. You know what I mean? Like you're just
totally.
So down in the dumps. And I had to get to a place where I was like, I accept that today I'm eating cookies all day.
Yeah.
I'm not sleeping very well, not going on walks.
Yeah.
But I also know that tomorrow may be different.
Yes.
Right? Like days are all different.
Yes. Give yourself the space.
Yeah. Did you drink enough water? You're like,
right.
Yes, I drink the water. I'm miserable, you know. Yeah.
And I'm also the last person that likes to be told what to do.
Oh, hell no.
Especially when I know what I got to do. I don't need you to tell me.
That's me and you, for sure.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I get it. And and I'm with you on.
And sometimes it's okay to be sad, you know?
Yeah, sometimes you're just sad.
Sometimes it's okay.
Sad day.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things that we're thinking about in this episode is reflecting on the ways that we've changed in the pandemic. And you have a real obvious one, right? Like you sobered up. You spent a year sober for the first time in a long time. And,
wow.
You know,
yeah. Probably
I don't know
since I was 10 years old.
Wow.
10 years old.
Oof. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, ooh.
Yeah. And you're in your 30s now. You're mid-30s. So you spent for the first time, you spent a whole solid year sober, right?
I did.
So that's one really obvious way that you changed. But can you think of more ways that you changed? Or maybe even what spending that year totally sober was like and maybe how that altered you?
I mean, obviously, like, there's this sobriety, right? But along with that is experiencing my emotions.
Mm.
I'm so used to changing how I feel that if I feel bad, I want to feel better. If I feel good, I still want to feel better, right? I'm so used to not actually going through the ups and the downs. What I've learned is you can't enjoy the ups if you don't have the downs.
Mm.
And I know that life's kind of a roller coaster. And if a roller coaster was just to go in a straight line, like I'd be like, give me my money back. I don't want this thing anymore, right? So that's what I mean by like going through some tough times and experiencing them, like staying present. Also being outside my comfort zones have been something that I've really liked. Pushing myself to try new things, even when they're scary. I think before I would have let fear stop me from attempting to do things, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, as I look at it, it's probably because I hated being vulnerable. Being able to have that courage to just show up and try something, even when it's scary or I'm feeling a little anxious about it. Sometimes you don't like looking like you don't know what you're doing.
Right.
You know, we all want to look like we have it all together. It's hard to be like, hey, I need some help with this, or I'm going to look like a fool for a little while, and that's okay.
I think for you especially, though, I mean, everybody, but you've always been a leader. You've always been, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. You've always been in charge. You've always been a protector, a provider, a leader. Those are roles that I think were given to you as the boy cousin.
Yeah.
But I think also it was within your natural wheelhouse. Like, it's not like that all just got forced on you and you reluctantly accepted it. Like, that's what you're good at. Those are things you're good at.
Oh, yeah.
So it is hard to be a beginner and a follower.
For sure.
And not good.
Right, right. Because, you know, like, you have to put your pride and your ego aside, right? Sometimes those things can stand in the way of a new relationship or, you know, a new experience. But, you know, a lot has changed when it comes to, like, my selfishness and self-centeredness. Mm. It's always been about what I wanted. I never really stop to think how these things that I'm doing might affect some other people. And now I do. I know that my words carry weight and that they impact people. Mm. I know that doing something kind for somebody else, even though it might not be seen by them as a gesture of good faith or whatever, it does something for me. It's like through giving that we receive. So, like, if I call somebody else to see how they're doing today, I'm not thinking about myself for that 5 minutes. You know what I mean? Allowing people to celebrate with me, right? Mm. You talked about me sharing with you some of those milestones, the 3 months, the 6 months, the 9 months, and then finally the year. I don't like to share my pain. I don't like people to have to be there for me. I don't know how to let people be there for me. I'm supposed to be this strong, you know, man who, and so for me to be, hey, like, this is something that I want to share with you.
Yeah,
it lets other people be there for me. And that's something that's definitely changed for me. I also am able to call people when I'm struggling. Like, I am so angry right now and I want to talk about it. And, like, I have friends that I can, like, call. They're like, hey, man, that sucks. And I never used to do it. I used to just be angry and I'd be walking around angry. And you run into me in the store and I would be the worst person you met in the day, right? Mm-hmm. And now I have people that I can call to share in those things. I let people share in my ups and my downs. And it helps me get through those times, man. They're so important at the times where I'm really struggling. Like, it's so vital for me that I have what I call the committee. And there's, like, a group of guys. They're on my committee. And if one of them doesn't answer, the other one will. And I can talk things through with them. And I think that's different. I don't think there's a lot of people who think men should be able to have other men that they express their feelings with.
Mm.
There's supposed to be this machismo. We do everything on our own and, you know, suck it up. Mm. Right? When I let go of that stuff, I'm really able to show some humility, set my ego aside, and check my pride.
I've found in the pandemic, and I don't think I realized that this was happening, but that I use leadership, or on some level, people tell me that I am brave because of the work that I've done and the situations I face. Those are not the things I'm scared of. I mean, they're a little scary, but the things I'm really scared of is being real close and vulnerable with people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's uncomfortable.
Yeah. So I can run out there and face down whatever.
Right. I seen you in the... Yeah.
But it's real hard for me to, like, take a compliment.
I know.
Or to be like I know. I'm a little proud of this. And I wanted totally. To tell you about it. You know, like, those exactly. things are so scary to me.
Exactly. I 100% relate to that, you know? Because I'm okay with you beating me up. Like, criticize me, you know, up and down, whatever. Yeah. I can take that. You want to give me a compliment? It makes me very uncomfortable. And I want to think of an excuse right away to, like, warrant that, right, in my head. And I'm like, it is uncomfortable. It takes work to let people celebrate you and share in your successes or what you're proud of or your achievements, you know?
And it's because it's just a fear of closeness. And it's, for sure. I guess, probably deep down, it's like a feeling you don't really deserve the compliment and probably you're going to let this person down in the future. You know what I mean?
Mm.
So you don't want them too close. So those are things I'm learning in the pandemic. It's like about really actually letting people be close to me, even people I would have defined as being close with me.
Yeah.
I don't think I was really letting them get that close.
Letting them all the way in. Yeah.
Even my best friends are.
Yeah, because then you can be hurt.
Yeah.
And nobody wants to be hurt, you know, and it's taken me years and I still need help with it. Like I still need practice on that, you know. There's times where I think I can do everything by myself and I don't need anybody.
Yeah.
It's pretty sad. You can be all alone, you know. And
I might have been having that morning this morning.
We go through that, right? We go through that. And it's okay, right? Because then you get to reset, you know, and I get to be like, I don't know. The actual truth is I do need people. I need relationship. I need connection. I need community. I need all those things because that's what makes, honestly, it's what brings a lot of joy.
Yeah.
If you have nobody to share it with, what good is it kind of thing, you know?
Really though, huh? Yeah. One thing I remember really specifically and held on to from our last conversation about this about a year ago is that they recommend when you're in recovery, like after you get out of rehab, that you not isolate. Isolation is considered like a danger sign. Like you're supposed to be alarmed if you're isolating because that might mean that you're on the path to stumbling.
It can be a trigger. It can be a trigger.
Yeah. And then so you get out of rehab, which was the inpatient rehab.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you come back to this guidance that's like isolate. Right. Yeah. So what are the things you did to manage that and how did it impact your work?
One of the things that I did was, you know, I came out and I was like willing. Right. So I started to be willing to figure out whatever it was going to take for me to gain that community. Right. So how am I going to get myself plugged in? One of the positive things that have come out of the pandemic, you know, how a lot of meetings are moving on to online. So that was a resource that I had to use immediately. Thank God that's actually been something that's very cool that's come out of it, because a lot of times everything was, you know, in person, right? And every group, whether it was, you know, any kind of recovery group, went online. And now at this moment, I have a meeting in my pocket any time of the day. Every hour or every 15 minutes, there's a meeting starting for me. And so immediately for me, I can be plugged in to a community of people that know what I'm going through.
Yeah.
And that have been through it a lot of times. So, I mean, that's been pretty huge, staying plugged in even through isolation, which is kind of it's the opposite, right? Of like, how do I navigate this if I have to be by myself? How can I surround myself with people? And that's been tough. You know, they did open up a small percentage of meetings. They cut down the occupancy, which was helpful because it is important to like see people. And
some people don't have a net.
You know, some people, that's the only place they know to go where they're gonna see people, and that might be the only time they do throughout the day,
right? And it is life or death, you know. I think that's important to remember about recovery for a lot of people.
Absolutely.
That, you know, you don't think about it the same way as you think of folks like in the hospital or something, but it is the
Absolutely.
same, you know, having those meetings and access to them.
It's dangerous not to,
right? It's
in all sincerity,
Yeah. Another thing I wanted to ask you about is, we've talked about this on the show a lot, but a lot of people who are part of a couple or a family are finding the time, you know, especially if everybody's working from home, and I don't know if that's the same for you, but are finding like the increased proximity to their loved ones around the clock. Some of it is great and some of it is hard.
Totally.
And you have recovery in the middle of your relationship too, right?
Yeah.
So how were you and Paige able to navigate that?
One of the good things is we're aware of our emotions now, right? So for instance, you know, I come home and we were pretty much together all the time, you know, for the first 11 months, you know, it was important for me to communicate like, hey, I'm feeling off right now. I'm feeling a little irritable. I just need some time to be by myself.
Yeah.
I don't even know what it is. It's like I could be just stressed from the day, or I can't even put my finger on it. Sometimes I just feel irritable or restless, right? Or discontented. It creeps up all the time, right? Sometimes I'm just hungry.
Yeah. Like, or sick of the pandemic,
or
right?
Whatever.
Or just whatever.
Yeah.
Frustrated, stressed out. Yeah.
I can't go do things that I want to do, and I'm frustrated. You know, those kinds of things. And instead, I'm like, hey, I'm just not feeling that great. I'm feeling a little off, and I just need some time before we start engaging. And that, to me, has been helpful. We are able to communicate those things when we're not feeling really all that great, which is hard. It's hard.
Yeah.
You know, first, if I don't know, like, how I'm feeling, if I don't realize why I'm feeling the way I'm feeling, then, like, I'm liable to take it out on somebody.
Yeah.
So like having the awareness piece is a huge piece. And then it's like, okay, now what can I do about it?
Totally. The other thing I was thinking about as I was driving here today is that we are seeing statistics coming through across the US that more people during the pandemic died from overdoses, relapses.
For sure.
That this has just been a hard or nearly impossible fight for a lot of people. I'm so proud of you for doing this in these circumstances, because I think also when I was listening to your previous interview, I was like, he sounds so good and like smart and played on the radio. Like, people don't realize that you were really in bad shape. Like, they might think I'm talking about a mild substance use problem. Like,
no,
it was severe.
Don't get it twisted. I'm a real alcoholic addict. And it did get dark.
And in the worst circumstances, you turned it around. And I know it was hard, Rolando. I know we're talking about a lot of the things that have gone well, and we're celebrating you, and we're talking about your skills and tools, and I know it wasn't easy.
It's not. I've known people in the past year that have died. One day they're sitting next to you, and the next day they're gone. Mm-hmm. And it's sad, man. It's like this disease, it's so real. You know, I'm grateful. I'm so grateful for the opportunity to live life, right? And to experience life. And, you know, I feel like God's given me a new lease on life. And this is how I pay the rent. Like, I show up places. I be there for my family. I work with other people that are struggling with this disease. That's the only way that I'm able to stay sober, is like by helping others. You know, if somebody was to tell me, you know, you're going to be a year sober and you're not going to use any drugs or alcohol for an entire year, I'd been like, you're crazy. Like, it's just that was so unfathomable to me, right? Because I had all these ideas about who I thought I should be or what I had to be. And when I let go of those things, that's when I can really encounter some peace in my life. Experiencing like sobriety, or it just gives you the opportunity to have like life and choice back, you know, because it didn't look like it was going to work out for a minute there. You know, it looked pretty grim, you know, but I really just want to emphasize that there's hope. It can be different, you know, but there's work to do. There's work to do, you know?
Me too. Yeah. Glad you're here.
Me too. Me too.
Yeah. Well, thanks for talking to me. I like this story for our 1 year episode, because I think a lot of us are tired and beat up and not doing well. And as I'm thinking back on a year, like, I don't know a lot that's really great to say about it. Last year was so hard.
Yes.
And I know they're saying, okay, there's light at the end of the tunnel for the pandemic. Researchers are saying, you know, and it's like hard to even generate hope, you know, because it feels like it's just so tired of it, you know? So I was really thinking, what am I going to do for this episode? And you sent me that picture and I was like, that's great, you know?
How cool that I get to be a part of that, you know? It's like, it's really special.
That was No More Normal executive producer Marisa DeMarco speaking with her cousin, Orlando Watts, about a year of new sobriety during the pandemic.
This is No More Normal. I'm Khalil Ekolona. We are looking back at the past year of the pandemic and how it has affected us all. We are not out of the woods yet, but we can reflect on the last 12 months. We heard from an educator, some people in my neighborhood, and a conversation between cousins. Coming up, more from our neighbors and a conversation between spouses on how the household has held up. Stay with us. Nomona will be right back. No More Normal is brought to you by Your New Mexico Government, a collaboration between KUNM, New Mexico PBS, and the Santa Fe Reporter. Funding for our coverage comes from the Kellogg Foundation and KUNM listeners like you. Support for public media provided by the Thornburg Foundation. Hear us each week on KUNM Sundays at 11 a.m. Find past episodes online at KUNM.org or wherever you look for podcasts. Previously, we met a few of my neighbors, Alicia Webb, Sean Gay and Catherine Hudson, Lynn Embick and David Hayden, Eva Avenue, Glenn Lopnow, and my housemates, Ben Eaglin and Stuart Doris. Now I want to introduce you to my youngest neighbor, Calliope Webb. How old are you?
7.
You're 7. Are you in school now?
Sort of.
How do you feel about COVID?
Like it's bullying me, because I can't really be with my friends.
That's hard, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
How about school? You're in first grade, you're starting school off, but then you have to go virtual. Did you like virtual school?
Not really.
Yeah, what about it is bad?
No idea.
You have no idea what's going on?
Mm-mm.
Yeah, I know how that feels. I hear you get to go to school twice a week, right?
True.
Do you enjoy that?
A little bit.
Yeah? Well, what parts of it do you like?
At least being able to see my friends in real life.
Yeah, see them up close and personal. Be able to play catch and stuff and run around.
Not catch.
You can't play catch?
No, because we touched the ball.
Being in the first grade is hard enough, let alone having a pandemic hit. The difficulty of adjusting to last year was felt by everyone. Ben breaks down where his head was at the time.
You know, all the conspiracy talk was still going on and all the idea that this was going to blow over or maybe, you know, there was no leadership telling us anything and the CDC had been hushed and the depth of how dark and how tough all of this could be was something that was beyond anything I had envisioned or could intellectually handle in its entirety.
Here's Sean Gay.
I don't think any of us really knew how to process it. Your mind wants to drop to like, oh, this is apocalyptic. Like, what's going on here? This has never happened in my lifetime. And by no means did I expect for it to last this long.
Lynn Embick on how the changes in work began to wear.
We've both had different COVID experiences because immediately my supervisors figured out ways that we could start working from home.
Mm-hmm.
And at first it was kind of fun, fixing lunch together and things like that. And then when my work kind of got in full swing, like we figured out, okay, here's a new strategy, we get it in place, then my schedule from home was overwhelming. And then David, about that time, lost his job completely. So then he was dealing with unemployment, and I'm dealing with feeling like I'm working more than I was when I was going in and clocking in somewhere.
So Dave is on unemployment. He wasn't the only one. Here's Catherine with her experience.
I was mad about the interruption of my income and then having to like deal with unemployment, because that was a really difficult thing to do, and it took me a very long time to receive any income. And when I finally like got a hold of unemployment, they had pretty much just told me that it was like waiting in a fax machine somewhere and to just kind of see what happens and whatnot. I would call hundreds of times a day.
Unemployment is hard at any age, so I ask this question to David. How long's it been since you've been without work? For this extended period of time?
Never. Never been without work for this long, since I was 14.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So it's been a struggle for me. There's days where I get up and why bother taking a shower or getting dressed or anything? And I'll go through periods of time like that. And then there's other days where I've got just all this energy and 10 projects going.
I got to see firsthand as my housemate Stu, who works a lot, had this to say about being at home.
I holed up 500 yards from here at my girlfriend's house. Mm-hmm. I did a lot of cooking. got real creative with it. It was fun cooking for the two of us every day for that length of time. And, you know, every day at about 5 o'clock, it was also time to have a cocktail. It became a very regular experience. And I think for a little bit, it was enjoyable. You know, we lived through the toilet paper scare.
Glenn was living with his partner for the first time during a pandemic, which he appreciates because it eliminates distractions. He explains here.
It limits the amount of stressors that can come into a relationship to whatever you create. And so if you're very mindful of that kind of situation, then you always try to be a little bit more careful about explaining what you're feeling, what you're going to be talking about. That's really been eye-opening for me in terms of relationships, because it's meant that we've started from this basis of very strong mutual respect and very strong needs to communicate.
Lynn and David on what they've been through as a couple.
I know for sure by December, I was having a tough time.
Yeah, we both were.
Yeah, we were kind of teeter-tottering. So we have a pretty good relationship where when I'm in crisis, he's like super supportive and there. And then, you know, when he sees that I'm okay, then it's okay for him to, you know. So we kind of go back and forth, and I wouldn't have wanted to go through this with anyone else. I will say that. But I think the longer it's gone on, the more challenging it's become.
One of the bigger tests to personal relationships came from the racial justice uprising, forcing us all to recognize very hard truths about our society. Eva explains where she was at as the protests were happening.
Like, I remember when Trump got elected and there was all these marches. I didn't participate in any of them because I don't want to die. And I think everyone that does participate is very brave. But what I imagined happening then is what was happening now. Like, I imagined back in 2016, the reaction to a marching crowd. I had imagined it would be like it was after George Floyd died.
Okay. Here's Alicia.
It's really stressful. I want to raise a kid who is part of the solution and not just ignoring this mess. There were tense moments. The helicopters made me more tense than the protesters, certainly. But, you know, you want to, like, be strong and be powerful and be, like, a confident mom and not make your kid nervous. But you also don't want to ignore what's going on. The struggle to be present in the moment, but not panic and not freak out and leave your, I've been calling this my boat. You don't want to tip your boat over, you know? And it's a delicate dance.
Stuart Doris.
With the murder of George Floyd and the amount of protesting that went on across the country and across the world, that to me became more of an important issue than even the pandemic. I was focused on really letting people know where I stood, and we put up our sign and we took pride in letting people know that we were on the side of what's right. And I don't think it's really hard to see what's right. And when people start to obscure it with misinformation, I just don't have time for those conversations.
Human beings have a lot of work to do. Maybe that's something to take from this past year. Glenn Lopnow shares a thought for us all.
I'm happy to be getting to know my neighbors in the community. I love walking around and meeting the people on the sidewalks or at their homes and chatting a little bit. And people are fascinating. You know, everybody has their story, and that story is a whole life. There's so much that joy and experience that can come from sharing those stories with other people. And in the end of it, we're all just people. It doesn't matter whether we're black, white, Hispanic, or male, female, old, young. It doesn't matter. We're all sharing our stories, and that's the joy of being a human being, I think.
Here's Calliope Webb on the future she wants to see.
Would you rather be a cat or do virtual school in the first grade?
Be a cat.
Yeah. I think I'd sign up with you with that. You get to take naps for like 14 hours a day. You can see at night. You can jump really high and run really fast.
True.
Yeah, it sounds awesome. How do you want things to be on your 8th birthday?
I want things to be normal with no masks, and I just want everything to be normal again.
So that was just a few thoughts from some of the people in my neighborhood. 1 year after our lives were fundamentally changed.
Oh, who are the people in your neighborhood? In your neighborhood, say, who are the people?
Next, KUNM's Ty Bannerman brings us a piece from his home.
Like just about every other kid in New Mexico, my two children came home for spring break last March and never went back to school. Since then, my wife, Courtney Fitzgerald, and I have been doing our best to help with their education while also working at our own jobs and managing a household. I interviewed Courtney about how she's been balancing her many roles for a year now and what will stick with her after it's all over. If it's all over. Hearing her speak, I thought about how, like a lot of women, she's also been doing emotional labor that often goes overlooked. And she's laboring this way overtime during a pandemic that was so hard emotionally for so many of us.
I am a mom to two kids who are both at home during the pandemic. I am a spouse, so I am, you know, responsible to be present for my partner and help make sure that we're balancing responsibilities and helping each other when we need that. I am a full-time employee for the University of New Mexico. I am a research scientist and I have, you know, bosses and coworkers and community partners and colleagues who count on me to deliver things that I say I'm going to do in a timely way. And I am a student. I am a full-time student in a doctoral program in communication at the university as well. And that means I have responsibilities to my own learning as well as to my fellow students and my faculty. But I also have responsibilities to myself. I should probably take care of myself, you know. Probably should exercise and eat well and find some time for balance, whatever that means. So my husband struggles with depression and anxiety. And over the last year, of course, with the pandemic and all of its accompanying horrors and stressors, that triggers a lot of mental health concerns that he feels. And when that happens, of course, you know, I need to step up my support, right? It's like having a family member with any kind of chronic illness. There are flare-ups. There are times when it becomes more acute and needs more attention. And in those times, you know, it's a matter of turning my attention and shifting my focus and priorities to accommodate that. It's difficult to really understand and kind of contextualize how the pandemic has affected the workload that I have, because it was already a really high workload before the pandemic. And just being in the same physical space with the rest of my family all day does kind of change the dynamics. I was much better able to compartmentalize things, I think, before the pandemic. And now everything is happening in the same physical space, which makes additional challenges. Like my kids need help because they're not paying attention in class, so I have to go and attend to that. Or someone needs food. No, I don't have to feed anybody else at work, but I do have to feed other people at home. So at work and school, there are places where I am physically present, where I'm doing specific tasks relevant to those locations, right? So when I'm in my office, I am typically doing work-related activities. When I'm in a classroom at university, I'm typically doing school-related activities. Or if I'm in the library, you know, I can study and it's quiet and no one's gonna ask me for anything. When I'm at home, I can try to make a schedule, but I could be doing a presentation to, you know, 100 people in the state, and my dogs will bark at the mailman, or my kids will begin fighting. But I need to be really grateful, too, because a lot of people don't have the option of working from home. It's hard to talk about it because this whole time I've just kind of been like, going, and not really thinking about it. I'm so drowning in tasks. Focusing on accomplishing tasks helps one push aside the kind of overwhelming concerns of a global pandemic that is killing people and all of the structural problems that we have in our society that are causing disparities in how this pandemic is affecting some people in different ways, and much worse for a lot of folks. If I focus too much on those things, it becomes almost overwhelming, and I feel really powerless. So focusing on tasks helps with that in the sense that I can turn my attention to things that are within the locus of my control. I feel like I sometimes do sacrifice my own well-being as far as putting off sleep in order to study, putting off deadlines and asking for extensions because my son has 6 missing assignments in a class and suddenly I'm needing to attend to that and make sure to support him so he can get his work done. I don't know that that's an uncommon thing. Again, when I'm having to balance all of these different moving parts and all of my roles in all these different contexts, I can't be everywhere at once and I can't be doing everything at once. You can't do it all the time, right? I could probably shower more. I could probably, you know, take time to take care of my skin. Definitely have not been exercising or eating as well. There was a time at the beginning of the pandemic when I was going for a run every morning and we were like eating vegetables and cooking at home more. And that didn't last longer than a couple of months, I think. When I look back on this time 10 years from now, I imagine that I will probably look back on it with both gratitude that it's over, I hope it's over in 10 years, but also probably also with some wistful like longing. Oh, remember how we could sleep in until 7 if we wanted to? And I'm probably going to miss seeing my kids as much as I've gotten to this past year. Even though they drive me nuts a lot of the time, even though, you know, there's a lot of challenge with making sure people are attending to their work, making sure folks are fed, making sure people aren't fighting with each other, which is not, thank God, something I have to do at my work. I think that I'm gonna miss having this time with my family. Yeah, I think that's gonna be a hard thing to let go of, going back to regular routines. But I don't know that we're gonna ever go back to something that's what we left. I have a feeling the world we reemerge into will look different and be changed forever. What would I keep for a family life is hard to say because it's a double-edged sword with your family. It's so nice to be around your family and it's also so infuriating sometimes and stressful sometimes, but also so wonderful at other times. I talked to my daughter who's 9 years old about what she likes about the pandemic, and she likes the idea of having more time at home. And I told her that I like the idea of getting to see her more, and she smiled and gave me a big hug, you know, and I felt good. I like having more time in her presence while she's a kid, because she's not going to be a kid forever, and she's going to go on and have her own life. I like having time with her now while she's little. And with my son while he's little. And I think that's really helpful for families.
For No More Normal, I'm Ty Bannerman, and that was my spouse, Courtney Fitzgerald.
We're back at it with YNMG at the end of the legislative session, here with a wrap-up of what happened this week and what is about to happen. It's Jeff Proctor, who is contributing editor to one of our partners, the Santa Fe Reporter. Jeff, thanks for being back with me.
Thanks for having me back.
So there's only about a week left in this session. We're rushing to the end, and there are a few bills this year related to police reform and civil rights. House Bill 4, the Civil Rights Act. Break down for us what this bill would do.
It does a couple of things. First of all, for a little bit of context, it comes from some work the legislature did last year in creating what they called the Civil Rights Commission. They spent a bunch of time last year and held a bunch of meetings sort of crafting what would it look like to try and give New Mexicans an opportunity to go and assert their civil rights under the state constitution and state courts. So this bill, it would allow New Mexicans who've been deprived of their civil rights under the state constitution, whether it's free speech, freedom of assembly, free from illegal search and seizure by the government, equal protection under the law, the same kinds of things you see in the Bill of Rights at the federal level. Although here in our state, some of those protections are a bit more expansive. In any event, if you feel that your civil rights have been violated by the government, you could now take that claim into state court and make that assertion. The other big deal under this bill is that the government would not be able to claim qualified immunity. Easiest way to understand it, it's not actually a defense that the government brings. It's something that stops the case before it ever gets to trial. Hmm. And it's essentially the government saying we are entitled to immunity from these claims because there is no such previous case that's exactly on point with this one.
Okay, so we keep hearing about how this legislature is more progressive, more left than it's been in the past. Is that holding true as lawmakers weigh in on this Civil Rights Act?
Yes and no, I would say. And the interesting thing about this too, Khalil, is I don't think this is really a left-right issue. In terms of the legislators themselves, I will say that I have, for the most part, not been surprised with where the opposition to this legislation has come from. There have been a few surprises. So the last big vote on this was in the Senate Judiciary Committee, and it passed on the narrowest of margins. It was a 5-4 vote with all three Republicans on that committee voting against the legislation, no surprise there. Mm-hmm. And then Daniel Ivy Soto, who's an Albuquerque attorney and a Democrat, also voted against the legislation, which is what made that vote so close. So has the progressive turn in the legislature had an impact one way or another on this bill? I think we'll find that out when it hits the Senate floor.
Are there any serious barriers to its passage?
There have been lots of serious barriers. There have been a lot of changes to this bill from its original form. For example, when it was first introduced, there was no cap on damages that plaintiffs could recover mm-hmm. in these civil rights claims. Now there's a $2 million cap. Okay. And that's a response to city and county governments and attorneys who represent school districts, for example, saying, hey, if we do this, you're running the risk of bankrupting some of the smaller communities.
We have Senate Bill 220 that's also moving forward. This one would require body cameras that automatically turn on sometimes. When would they turn on?
Yeah, that's a good question. And this is an interesting bill, too. And just for listeners, really quickly, on the Civil Rights Act, that one is on the precipice right now. So if the Senate says yes, if they vote in favor of that bill, it goes to the governor's desk.
Okay.
Right? Because it's already passed the House. So in terms of Senate Bill 220, it's still a little bit of a long shot at this point, I would say, for it to get all the way across the finish line. Mm-hmm. But anyway, what that bill would do, number one, it would require this new breed of police body camera so that when something like an aggravated pursuit begins and the officer flips on his cherry tops and hammers the gas pedal, that would kick on the camera.
Okay.
Or when the camera system detects the sound of a gunshot, it would kick on the camera. Or when the officer goes and pulls his service weapon out of the holster, it would kick on the camera. It would also clarify some of the stuff in the law that was passed last year requiring the use of body cameras. It would give officers some exceptions for when they don't have to turn the cameras on. That would be like when they are in the middle of some sort of an undercover operation, right? So right now, all citizen encounters are required to be recorded. This bill has had opposition and I think is going to continue to have opposition.
I want to thank you again for being with me and give me the breakdown rundown of everything happening at the Roundhouse. He's a contributing editor for the Santa Fe Reporter, Jeff Proctor. Always a pleasure.
My pleasure indeed. Thank you, sir.
As we head into the final stretch of the legislative session, make sure that you stay updated daily with your New Mexico government daily updates. Find them anywhere you look for this podcast online or just go to KUNM.org. We want to thank all of our guests for offering their experience and expertise. Many thanks to artist Bug Carlson for providing artwork to the online version of this episode. Thanks to Jazztone, the producer, Cheo, Dom Life, Business School, Sundog, and Olaud Records for providing music for the show. Khaki, Pope Yes Yes Y'all, and Bigawatt produced some of the show's themes. No More Normal is executive produced by Marisa DeMarco, is produced and hosted by yours truly. Taylor Velasquez assists with social media, story generating, and editing. Special thanks to Nash Jones and Ty Bannerman for their contributions. I'm Khalil Ekolona. For everyone here at No More Normal, thanks for listening.